McGraw's off on vacation for a few days. I'm Paul Harris, proud to be back behind the microphone and filling in for him. John Feinstein is one of America's great sports writers, and I got to tell you, one of America's great radio guests as well. I've lost count of the number of times John has joined me on the radio in the last quarter of a century. I'm happy to have him back on today to help him promote his new book, which is called One-on-One, Behind the Scenes with the Greats in the Game. John, good morning. How are you?
Paul, good morning. It's great to talk to you again. How are you?
I'm doing just great. And what a wonderful read this book is yet again. You know, you've done it for years, both with the recent fiction books for kids and for all the other books, from A Season on the Brink to Q School to A Good Walk Spoiled to so many others. Congratulations on this, where you go through kind of your history of talking to athletes. And the thing that kept going through my mind as I read this was I kept wondering, how different is it to be a sports guy interviewing an athlete now in 2011 compared to how it was, say, 25 years ago when you first started out with it?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and thanks for the kind words. But it's really difficult now to do what I have been able to do for the last 25 years because the world we live in has changed so much. When I first went to work at the Washington Post, there was no internet, there was no sports talk radio, there were no websites that athletes used to get their messages out, there was no Twitter. You went places, you went in locker rooms, you met people, you got to establish relationships with them, you developed trust over time. There were no interview rooms back then, essentially, and I was able to get to know people, and probably, Paul, as you know, more important, get them to know me, because when you establish a two-way relationship, that's the way you get people to trust you and let you go places they might not otherwise let you go, and tell you things they might otherwise not tell you. Clearly, my ability to establish a relationship with Bob Knight back in the 1980s led to Season on the Brink, which was 25 years ago, and that allowed me to go on from there and really pick and choose my topics for books. And in this book, I did something a little different because I told a lot of stories that involved me. In the past, I've left myself out of the books. I always figured people wanted to know about Bob Knight, not John Feinstein, Mike Krzyzewski, not John Feinstein, John McEnroe, and many others. And in this book, I talk about how I met some of them, how I developed relationships with them, some of the funny stories about some of my misadventures in trying to establish relationships with people. So in that sense, it's different, but your point is very well taken. If I was coming into the business today, the challenges I would face to establish those relationships would be much more difficult than when I first got into it years ago.
Is one of the things that's an impediment to doing the job of being a sports writer or just a sports reporter now the fact that you don't have as much access to the locker rooms and they force you instead to go sit with the rest of the media in the interview room where the drape behind them has the corporate
right.
logo and there's very, very... it's a very theatrical setting?
Yes, there's no question about it. And I have tried to make the case to people that it hurts the athletes and the coaches and the teams and the individuals as much as it hurts we in the media because, as I said, you don't have a chance to develop relationships or trust. And it's not a surprise that golf has skyrocketed in popularity in recent years. It's not just because of the Tiger Woods phenomenon. It's because golf has allowed the media to continue to have access to the players. You can go in the locker room. You can walk on the range and talk to people. Paul, I do most of my reporting when I'm at a PGA Tour event without a notebook out, without a tape recorder out. I just go and talk to guys about their families, about last night's ball game, whatever it is, so they can see me as a person. Tennis, which is the other major individual sport, there is no access to the players. And fans, as a result, don't feel like they know them the way people feel like they know golfers. And Roger Federer has been every bit as wonderful a champion, in many ways a better champion than Tiger Woods because he's a much nicer person in the last 10 or 12 years, but he hasn't gotten nearly the attention because of the fact that nobody really knows Roger Federer. Now, all the guys I know in tennis say he's a terrific guy, but public doesn't really know him because they never see him except in those artificial interview rooms you're talking about.
So is that the fault of the tennis event organizers, or is it the fact that the media just isn't as interested in an individual sport like tennis as they are in the NFL or Major League Baseball?
Well, there's not as much media coverage for golf or tennis as there is the NFL or Major League Baseball or the NBA whenever they get around to playing. There's no doubt about that. But the tennis media has been cowed over 25 years of being beaten down into thinking the only reporting you can do is out of interview rooms. I was president of the U.S. Tennis Writers Association back in the 90s, and I spent years banging my head against the wall with the ATP Tour, the WTA, the individual tournament director saying, look, it's good for you if we have access. More people will want to cover your events if they have real access to the athletes. And the athletes will be better known if we have real access to them. And I couldn't get through because in tennis, the agents run the sport. And the agents don't want their players to have any contact with the media unless they control it. And really, one of the reasons tennis is essentially a dead sport in this country, other than during Wimbledon and the U.S. Open, is because of that, because nobody can really relate to their athletes. And I think it's a shame because I love the sport.
Talking with John Feinstein about his new book, One-on-One, here on the Big 550 KTRS. In fact, you covered tennis, and there's a wonderful story you have in the book. Well, I mean, a wonderfully told story. It's not a feel-good story in any way, about how Mary Carrillo got kind of shoved aside by ESPN because she wouldn't go along with the tennis establishment, which essentially said no negative stories about tennis players, right?
Yeah, actually, to Mary's credit, Paul, she really shoved ESPN aside, which very few people can do or will do nowadays because ESPN is such a monolith. But Mary had worked for ESPN for years, and she had had battles with her producers and other people over the cheerleading aspect of ESPN's coverage of tennis. Everything is great. Every player is wonderful. Nobody ever does anything wrong. And it really came to a head during the 2010 U.S. Open. You remember the incident with Serena Williams in 2009 when she basically threatened a line judge after she had called her for a football and ended up losing the match on a point penalty that caused her to lose right there because it was match point. And the next year when ESPN was planning their pre-tournament special, Mary brought up, okay, how are we going to deal with Serena? That was the biggest story of the Open last year. Oh, well, we're not doing that. We're not going to bring that up. And she, what, are you kidding me? You know, that's like not telling people what the Electoral College vote was in a presidential election. And they said, no, we're not bringing it up. She found out later that ESPN was wooing Serena to come on their air during the Open because she was hurt. And they wanted her to, you know, sort of try out as a future color commentator. And so she was very upset about this and then saw Andy Roddick get into a similar situation on a footfall call while she was watching a match at night that she wasn't working. And, again, no mention of Serena, no showing of the tape, no comparing of the two incidents, nothing. And essentially she woke up the next morning and said, I can't do this anymore. I can't work with these people or for these people, and quit in the middle of the U.S. Open. Thank God Mary still has so many outlets that she could afford to do that. And the Tennis Channel scooped her up about 30 seconds after she left ESPN, in addition to all her other work.
Yep.
And of course, ESPN, when people found out she had left, put out this fable that she had asked out of her contract because she wanted to do so many other things. And because she'd been so good for so many years, they had graciously allowed her to leave, which is, again, like I said, it's a fable.
Yeah, and a real shame, because among the great broadcasting teams, and there have been many of them through the years, the team of Dick Enberg, John McEnroe, and Mary Carrillo on a tennis major is probably in the top five all time.
Well, and the good news is you could still get them on CBS, although
right.
I think Dick is retiring from doing tennis. I think this Open was his last one.
I think you're right.
Still doing tennis for CBS, for NBC. She still does all the stuff she does with HBO.
Yep.
But you're right, the three of them together, especially John and Mary, because they've known each other literally since they were children. And when they sometimes fuss at one another about what's going on, it's great because Mary's one of the few people who's not intimidated by McEnroe.
While we're speaking about ESPN in a negative light here, let's talk about how they butchered your book, A Season on the Brink, when they turned it into a TV movie.
You have to bring that up.
I have to bring it up because
I'm just getting over it now.
I've known you a long time, and I've never asked you about this, and I've also never asked you what Bobby Knight's reaction was.
Well, to the movie? I mean, it's the one thing he and I agreed on. we both thought it was a cartoon, which it was, and there is a someday when I write my real memoir, which will be called "What Do You Mean the Food Sucks?" Because I once wrote a 100-inch story on a basketball camp run by a guy named Howard Garfinkel, a legendary figure, and it was 99.5 inches, were about how great the camp was and how wonderful everything was, and I mentioned the food was bad, and that was one of the camp traditions, and he called me the next day, and his entire reaction to the story was, "What do you mean the food sucks?" So that'll be the name of title of my memoir when I write it. But,
okay.
But the basic backstory with ESPN was I had left them shortly after they bought the rights to the book. They brought someone in to write the script who wrote it horribly, who didn't know anything about basketball. Then they wanted me to come back and doctor the script. But they said, if we let you doctor the script, you have to agree to do A, B, C, D, E, and F for us. And I said, no, I'm not doing that. And so the script went on as is, and as you said very accurately, it was arguably the worst television movie ever made.
Mm-hmm. All right, before we go, and I know you're running around and you're doing a lot of promotion for the book, and I hope you sell a lot of copies of the book, and I hope I help you sell a couple here today. A little bit of advice from you for aspiring young sports writers who, you know, they're going to have to deal with the interview room instead of the locker room. They're going to have to deal with the fussy agents and all that sort of stuff. A little bit of advice from you, and I guess the central question of that is, how important is it for them to really befriend these athletes?
Well, I don't know if I'd go so far as befriend, but establish relationships. I think that's critical for any reporter covering anything. You know, there was a review written of One-on-One, very kind review, which said that the book is my career is kind of a relentless search for access and more access. That's the way it was described. And I think that's accurate because I think access is critical in any reporting that you do. And what you have to do is find a way to go around the interview rooms, find a way to fight City Hall, you know, demand more. Don't settle when people say, you know, I was talking to a young reporter from the Post, Steve Yonda, who covers the University of Virginia for us, and I was asking him how the access was with the Virginia football team, which had a pretty good year this year. He said, well, whenever I want to interview somebody, they set me up on the phone. And I said, no, you can't do that. You got to tell them no. You got to say, I'm coming down there, and I want to meet with the guy over lunch or over a cup of coffee or in the SID's office, worst case scenario. But you got to be able to look these guys in the eye. So when you see them the next time, they know who you are, and they have some comfort level with you. You do it on the phone, they won't remember who you are 30 seconds after you hang up. And that's the kind of thing that I think as a reporter of any age, you have to do. You can't just settle when they say, okay, we're going to do it this way. You have to go back and say, no, that's not good enough. I want more. And sometimes they'll say no, but other times they'll say yes. And if you win half the battles, then that's better than winning no battles.
Some great advice from a man who's been pretty successful at doing this for more than a quarter of a century, John Feinstein, who collects stories from that quarter century in the new book called One-on-One, Behind the Scenes with the Greats in the Game. Congratulations on it, John. It's always great to talk to you.
Paul, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure, and have great holidays, and I hope we do it more often in the future.
I look forward to it. I hope you have a great holiday as well. John Feinstein here on the Big 550 KTRS.